You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko just mon talking wa no mai haru mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, tērā rua te koumatoru o hōngoingoi. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare, Thursday the 23rd of July. You're listening to 95BFM, my name is Justin, and starting from this week I will be hosting the Thursday Wire. But if you prefer Mary Margaret Slack's voice to mine during your Thursday lunchtime, don't worry too much, because she will be on Fridays from now on. We also have a slight producer reshuffle, which James Tapp is the new Thursday producer, but unfortunately he's not here right now because of other engagements. What a busy man. But the show goes on. FIKINE on the show today. I caught up with Justice Minister Andrew Little and we discussed work culture in Parliament, COVID-19 managed isolation, Te Whakahotea treaty settlement and advertising around the upcoming two referendums. James talks to the Assistant Privacy Commissioner, Assistant Privacy Commissioner Lise McPherson in the second part of a series on privacy law. I caught up with Zoe Canandes on Neighbourhood Watch and we talked about welfare in Australia under COVID-19, new federal environment laws and raising the age of criminal responsibility. And finally, because of technical circumstances this morning, Sports and Recreation Minister Grant Robertson's Press Secretary Chris Bramwell spoke to him on our behalf about funding children with disabilities into sport. You can get into touch with me with any thoughts you have, maybe on recent events. Tukupatuhi mai, you can do so by texting me on 5395 or via mai rane, call me in studio on 309-3879. And don't forget you can always catch these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. I tēnei wā tonu. Let's get into it.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
I caught up with Justice Minister Andrew Little yesterday afternoon because he is travelling to Taranaki this morning. We spoke about the situation on COVID-19 managed isolation, the treaty settlement process with Te Whakatohea Iwi in the Bay of Plenty, and advertising surrounding the two upcoming referendums. But first, I asked Andrew, who now has the workplace relations and safety portfolio after Ian Lees-Galloway was dismissed yesterday for having an inappropriate relationship with a staffer at the time, about workplace culture at Parliament. My first question is related to your new workplace relations and safety portfolio, and it's considering what happened in the past few days with Andrew Falloon and Ian Lees-Galloway. Do you think there is kind of a gender power imbalance, especially when we are in politics?
Look, it's obviously very unfortunate when you get situations where people in a position of power and responsibility undertake activities that clearly look like an abuse of that position. So is it sort of endemic around Parliament? I don't think so. I think most parliamentarians know that, you know, we have a position of considerable responsibility and privilege, frankly, that goes with it, and people manage themselves and acquit themselves accordingly. But there are going to be exceptions. And look, sometimes people are... Well, who knows what motivates people and what they do, but it does happen, and I think the important thing is that the way that it is handled sends a very clear signal about what conduct is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. And on both occasions, you know, the leaders of National and Labor have drawn a very clear line about what's not acceptable.
The Parliament last year has appointed Debbie Francis to conduct a report on bullying in the workplace, and she found that inappropriate behaviour is on a regular basis. But based on that, do you think there is a toxic environment in Parliament?
Look, there are some aspects about the parliamentary environment as a workplace, and certainly for MPs, That is not pleasant. That can be better. But the reality is, you know, this is a collection of 120 people there or thereabouts who are very passionate, very determined, have very firm views. Some have big egos. Some are very energetic and animated. And some people go over the top, and particularly people who are not familiar with the environment, who are new to it. It can change behaviours. And I think, you know, we've just got a lot of work to do to make sure that people understand that there are limits to acceptable conduct, that this is a place where you can differ and disagree but still show respect for each other, that we don't have to get into some of the behaviours that we see exhibited here. That said, you know, we've got a long way to go to get there. But equally, I know that, you know, some good work has started. There are some MPs on all sides of the House who are working very hard to make sure people understand what's expected and what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable.
I see recently that there has been talks of a code of conduct between parliamentarians down in Wellington. Is Labour going to support that?
We've supported a set of kind of expectations, if you like, about conduct. I think the nervousness, I think, by some MPs about signing up to a code of conduct is that this is a place where people are in conflict, the nature of the place. There is a conflict of ideas and disagreement, and there is debate. And sometimes that debate is animated. Sometimes it's a bit silly. Sometimes it is conducted in an extraordinarily respectful way. And you saw the way the House debated. You know, usually when it debates conscience issues, actually they can have very, very good and decent debates. But a code of conduct ran the risk of kind of shutting down or limiting MPs contributing to debates, even if they're sometimes a bit animated and even if they're sometimes a bit over the top. That said, I think every MP accepts that this has got to be a place where, regardless of which party we're in, which side of a debate we're on, that we do show respect towards each other. Even if we have to disagree, or even if we do disagree on a regular basis.
And moving on to another topic, I want to talk about COVID-19 isolation. Now, quite a lot of us, me included, were anticipating that Cabinet would be start charging people for managed isolations this week. So why didn't that happen?
Oh, I think, well, Cabinet's been debating it and discussing it. And look, you should expect an announcement on that fairly soon. There are a number of, it's not a simple issue. I mean, for one thing, look, we know that the government is going to huge expense at the moment as people cross the border. We are requiring them, it is a compulsory thing, that they are either in managed isolation for a 14-day period, or if they have the virus, they go into quarantine, and that can be for a longer period, a period of up to 28 days. That is a compulsory requirement, but it is costing the government a lot of money to do that. On the other hand, we also have the New Zealand Bill of Rights provision that says that any New Zealand citizen or resident is entitled to re-enter the country. That's a basic human right that people have. That Act says that you can put limitations on those rights, but they have to be reasonable and consistent with, you know, what would happen in a free and democratic society. The question is whether imposing a charge of, the National Party's talked about $3,000, even if it was that much, does that cut across that right? And it has the potential to do that, because if it means that somebody says, a New Zealand citizen or resident overseas says, I cannot now afford to return to my country that I'm entitled to return to, and that would be indefinite, that might be seen as an undue limitation on that basic human right to return to the country. So those are the things that we've had to weigh up. I think there is certainly a lot of public sympathy for those people, for example, knowing that we have managed isolation in place, leave the country and then want to return, and have that cost picked up. And I think, you know, my view is that that is a cost that actually the person should bear, because they know that when they come back into the country, they're going to have to go into managed isolation, and they take that risk. But look, we'll make an announcement on that fairly soon, I expect, on what exactly we're doing.
National also said they will charge people, deportees from Australia as well. I just want, what are your personal thoughts? Should we charge deportees for managed isolation?
Yeah, look, I think, as I say, it's not about my personal view. I've contributed to the debate in Cabinet, and there will be a collective decision of Cabinet that will be announced in due course. But I think, and that decision will have weighed up those various things, and they apply as much to deportees as they do to every other citizen. The National Party comes up with that sort of stuff because they think that there's mileage in sort of beating the chest and puffing it out and looking like they're being tough on deportees. They forget that actually many of the deportees are not people with a criminal conviction. They've simply been declared as unacceptable for Australia, because the threshold for Australia to deport people is very low. It doesn't require a criminal conviction. It requires that you don't meet a standard of sort of good character, and some of those people are in straitened circumstances. So charging them $3,000 isn't particularly going to help their situation. And I think we've got to do something that is right for New Zealand. But we'll make an announcement on that in due course.
The minister in charge of border control, Megan Woods, had said couple of hours ago that we are exhausting capacity for isolation and there could be exemptions. Do you think this will pose a risk for public health?
We are managing it very tightly. I think the problem we have is that virtually every hotel that could be used for isolation or as an isolation facility is being used. And we're at capacity. So we're working with the airlines to make sure that we better manage the flow of people coming back to New Zealand. That's definitely underway. But in terms of exceptions or exemptions, that has to be looked at very, very closely, because the risk is there. Pretty much every other place in the world still has a major problem with COVID-19. And we are determined we are not going to put New Zealanders at risk. So the expectation that people will quarantine is very, very high, and any exceptions or exemptions would be very, very strictly controlled. We are looking at, as we have, as has been publicly indicated, what we do with countries that are free of COVID, and that includes some of the Pacific Island countries, and we're in constant contact with them about whether we could have what has been described as a travel bubble. We are free of COVID-19, they are free of COVID-19, providing their appropriate safeguards, then we should look at whether we can open up the borders, at least between us and those Pacific Island countries.
And moving on to an issue that correlates your treaty negotiations portfolio, it's about the Whakatohea settlement. So I have seen recently that some activists and claimants are going through a Waitangi tribunal hearing about the settlement with the Whakatohea iwi. So what has happened?
So the Whakatohea iwi got to the point of agreement in principle with the Crown a couple of years ago. Some people were concerned about that and challenged the mandate of the Whakatohea negotiators to the tribunal. The tribunal came out and said, look, you know what, the best way to test this is to pose a couple of questions to the Whakatohea population. First of all, do you want the negotiations to continue between the mandate holder and the Crown? And secondly, do you want a district inquiry, that is to say a tribunal inquiry, into the issues to do with Whakatohea? And the interesting thing is that when the voting came back, it supported both propositions. People wanted the negotiations, or a majority wanted the negotiations to continue, but a majority also wanted there to be an inquiry because they wanted to tell their story and they wanted a record of it. And so, look, I took quite a bit of time with my colleague Nanaia Mahuta, who was the other one who was to make this decision. And in the end, we said, look, let's do both. It is possible to do both, and it is possible for the tribunal to have the time to do an inquiry and for any findings to be incorporated into the historical record or anything else that the Crown does. But equally, given what's on the table and the package that's been developed, a lot of Whakatohea were saying, look, we also want the benefit of that. So we've done both. I met with Whakatohea people recently. I know it's been described by some people as a secret meeting. It wasn't. It was publicised and advertised. It was held on a marae whose tikanga is that anybody can turn up. and a lot of people did turn up, and it was a good day. But that's the approach we've taken. We think it sort of achieves both objectives.
But could a tribunal hearing and settlement negotiations happening concurrently affect one another?
Well, the way that it would is that the tribunal does their inquiry. They make some findings, because part of their job is to make historical findings. And that can be incorporated into, for example, the historical account or other, you know, other aspects of the settlement. Once the settlement is agreed, there's still a lot of work to do before it is finalised and enacted and is carried out in terms of, you know, payment over of money and return of land and that sort of thing. So I think people are concerned that everything will sort of take off with a hiss and a roar and be rushed. It won't be. These things have to be undertaken in a measured sort of way. And there is time to conduct an inquiry and for the conclusions of that inquiry to be incorporated in, you know, whatever happens around the negotiated settlement.
And let's go on to the final part of today's topic. I want to talk about advertising surrounding two of our referendums. It's almost, I think it's all around 60-odd days to the referendum day. Yeah. And I just want to know, what are the rules surrounding advertising?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, except that there are restrictions on it, and there's restrictions on the amount of money that people supporting one side or the other and either of the referendum questions can spend advertising or, advertising their kind of particular view or calling for people to vote in a particular way. The rules for advertising on the referendum questions, where they are advocating for one side or the other, are the same as for MPs or political parties advertising. So there are restrictions on it. And they have to be, the publisher of the advertisement has to be identified. There is a limit to what you can spend on it. So there are rules about it, and people who wish to advertise need to acquaint themselves with it.
I see you have recently criticised some foreign groups for advertising in the referendums. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, there's a large American outfit. It's backed by corporate America, basically. They typically advertise, they say that they're looking at alternatives to marijuana. Actually, they are just dead opposed to it, which is a fine position to take. But I don't think we need the deep pockets of American organisations for New Zealanders to have a debate about about legalisation of cannabis. New Zealanders are quite capable of that themselves. I'm just not sure that they necessarily help the debate. We don't need Americans telling New Zealanders how they should, what they should think and how they should make up their minds.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei marunga, BFM. You're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM. My name is Justin, and that was our weekly catch-up with Justice Minister Andrew Little. We just have a text from our regular texter Peter, who said psychological profiling is needed for all politicians who are pursuing public office. This will prevent controllers and power freaks from getting office, and otherwise we get what we have right now. And if you don't forget, thanks Peter, and don't forget, if you want to let me know your thoughts, you can text me any opinions on 5395 or call me in studio on 309-3879. It's just up to 25 minutes past noon, and we will be back for a quick break.
Whānau Marama New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2020 with 79 feature films and 7 collections of shorts, all from 41 countries, screening at home online. Premiere tickets are now on sale, so get online, check out the programme and get settled in for the cinematic event of the year. Whānau Marama New Zealand International Film Festival, July 24th to August 2nd. Find everything you need at nziff.co.nz.
How is 95BFM breakfast like an egg?
Sunny side up.
Does it have egg vitamins?
Oh, it's because Rachel's real cooked.
Is that meant to be a yolk?
95BFM breakfast with Rachel. All the essentials to start your day off right. scrambled, fried, and seasoned with news, politics, media, music, and a healthy dollop of Tess. BFM Breakfast with Rachel, 7 to 10 a.m. weekday mornings on 95BFM. Thanks to Coda Wealth, the personalised KiwiSaver.
Think your KiwiSaver is no big deal? Getting it wrong could lose you hundreds of thousands of dollars. Get your free KiwiSaver advice today from Coda. With some of the lowest fees in the country, their 100% Kiwi-owned and operated KiwiSaver scheme is personalised for you. Don't wait. Get the most out of your KiwiSaver today. Visit Koura at kouraweealth.co.nz or call 0800 527 547. That's 0800 527 547.
Baby, what's wrong?
Oh, I dreamed that 95BFM added even more prizes to their winter giveaway.
And then the scary thing happened?
Oh, no. It was a happy scream.
Alt and 95BFM's ultimate winter road trip has just gotten bigger.
Two nights accommodation at the Powderhorn Chateau in Ohakune. 2-day ski passes for you and a mate thanks to Mount Duapehu. Full snow equipment hire from TCB Ohakune.
And now, a $100 book voucher from Time Out Bookstore. A chi hamper including two new and unreleased chi flavours, a Rudy's goodie pack and a Huffer Super Down jacket.
Truly the roadie of a lifetime.
Just text 5395 with the word winter and your B-card number to go in the draw. Alt and 95BFM's ultimate winter road trip. Thanks to Alt, the definitive alternative. Check them out at getalt.com.
I'm Paddy Garin. This is the fucking news on The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and in the final part of a series on the new privacy laws to come into effect on December 1st this year, producer James Tapp talked to Lise McPherson, the Assistant Privacy Commissioner. Last week, we heard from Gihan Gunasekara, a privacy law expert, about what is being added to the privacy law. Well, this week, we are talking about how New Zealanders perceive our laws. In the survey released just after the new Privacy Act was passed, it showed two-thirds of New Zealanders wanted more privacy regulations among a number of other statistics, which James discusses with McPherson. He started off by asking about what New Zealanders want in terms of privacy law.
Firstly, what has the survey shown about what New Zealanders want when it comes to privacy law?
Well, first and foremost, it says they want more. Basically, nearly two-thirds of the respondents are in favour of more regulation, particularly about what companies can do with their personal information. So, and that ties in with some of the other information that came out of the survey, which said that New Zealanders' privacy concerns centre on things like unauthorised business sharing of their personal information, theft of banking details, and security of personal information online. So what people are telling us is they want a bit more regulation so they can feel more protected.
Now, this survey was conducted before the new Privacy Act was passed.
Yeah.
Would you expect that there'd be different results now that it's going to be put in place in December?
Well, yeah, the good news for people who wanted more regulation is we are getting it. 1st December, the new Act comes into force. The old Act was dated. It really didn't pick up on things like the new information technology. So would I expect people to feel more comfortable down the track? I think that once they see it in effect, I'm hoping they will. What comes in with the new Privacy Act are a number of things, in particular and quite topically, mandatory notification of privacy breaches. People will have to tell us when there's a privacy breach, which is, you know, causes severe or serious harm. We're going to have some more teeth. The Privacy Commissioner gets some teeth, so we'll be able to issue compliance notices to actually get people to comply with the Privacy Act. We'll be able to issue binding access determinations. Now, that legal terminology, but essentially what it means is you as a person have the right to get access to your own information. You have the right to ask for it and to receive it. Sometimes people can be a bit slow with this. So now we've actually got, we'll have the ability to demand that information is released when people are a bit slow or reluctant to do it.
Okay, so there was a number of statistics that were also gained from the survey, and one of those was that women were wanting more privacy regulation than men. Is there any reasoning behind this?
Well, I could posture a number of things, James, that women are thinking more about this, thinking more about some of the areas that they are concerned about, things like health regulation, health privacy, for example. Look, there could be any number of different reasons for it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And another statistic was that 18 to 29-year-olds were less aware of privacy law than most others. Mm. Is this concerning, considering that they're most engaged with the online world?
Yeah, it's actually something I was going to raise with you, James. We get told time and time again in surveys like this that younger people are less concerned about privacy than older people. And I'd really, you know, really want to test that with your listeners. You know, you might be less concerned about sharing information with your friends, but are you less concerned about sharing information online? Do you think seriously about what happens with your information when you are, you know, buying stuff online? Are you thinking about your the personal information that you share? But particularly from our perspective, we are concerned about less about the fact that people know about the Privacy Act and more about the fact that if they don't know about the Privacy Act, do they actually know about their rights? Do they know that they can complain to us? Are they taking this seriously? And when they do have an issue, do they know where to come?
So is there any way that there could be more education so that people know that they could come to the Privacy Commissioner?
So the good news there is on our website, we are gearing up for the start of the new privacy legislation. We will have information on our website which will include education modules for people to take and learn more about the Privacy Act. We'll have an advertising campaign which is designed to raise people's awareness, and a variety of other tools that are really out there to say, look, you know, this legislation is about you. It's about protecting your personal information, and it's really important to us that you understand your rights and you know where to come when you need help.
Okay, and there was also reporting of lower knowing of the Privacy Act from the Māori and Pacifica respondents. Same sort of line of questioning, is there any reasoning behind that?
Well, actually, it's an area that with the new Privacy Act and what we're describing here at the Office of the Privacy Commissioner is Privacy 2.0, one of the things we're really conscious of is that we need to better serve the whole community of New Zealand, and that we recognise when we look at our complaint statistics, for example, that we don't get many complaints from Māori or Pacifica, and that's something that we want to address. We want to make sure that we're really extending our engagement and ensuring that all communities across New Zealand, in particular Māori and Pacifica, understand their rights and understand where they can come to complain. And that's going to be something we'll need to work on with Māori organisations and across Te Ao Māori.
Now, finally, you did mention before that the previous privacy law was quite outdated, and I mean it has been a long time coming for this to really form. So going forward, is there potential for privacy law to become even more robust as technology is rapidly evolving?
Well, yes, the Privacy Act was 27 years old. This is the first change since then. We would like to, we will constantly keep a focus on how to improve the legislative framework, and one of the things we will be looking to do too, though, is to engage with other regulators, work with some of the other people across New Zealand whose role is to help protect New Zealanders and their information in a variety of different ways, and see whether we can actually, you know, get some leverage by doing things jointly together. But watch this space. We want to use the new tools that we've got well. It's great to have some additional teeth, and you can look for the Privacy Commissioner to be using those. But at the same time, we will continue to work across New Zealand and internationally to see where the law can be improved.
Are there any other comments you'd like to make?
So the 18 to 29-year-olds say they don't have as much awareness of the Privacy Act. It's not the legislation per se we're concerned about, it's we want them to understand their rights.
Yeah.
We want them to know what their rights are, what to look out for, and where they can come when they've got concerns.
Okay.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was James talking to Assistant Privacy Commissioner Liz McPherson. And if you want to hear the first part of this series, you can find it in the BCast on our website. Now, let's go over to Australia.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, I spoke to our correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe Canandes, on federal environment laws and a petition to raise the age of criminal responsibility. However, we talked first about updates to welfare. Here's Zoe.
So the government have announced in the past week that the JobKeeper payment, which is the wage subsidy payments that we are receiving here in Australia if we've lost our job, our hours have been decreased due to COVID-19, and the job seeker payment, which is what previously was called Newstart, the welfare payment which unemployed Australians receive from Centrelink, that they would further on after September. So they've changed their tune a little bit to a bit of a surprise and a bit of a relief as well, to be perfectly honest. These payments were meant to finish in September, and the job seeker payment was meant to go back to normal in September, which would have been below the poverty line in Australia. So they have decided that JobKeeper will fall from $1,500 a fortnight to $1,200 a fortnight in September. Then it will fall again in 2021. And then the job seeker payment will fall from $1,100 to $800 a fortnight in September. It is an interesting shift from their steadfast, pretty heavy-handed approach of these supplements that they were going to end, and they haven't. And it is good news, but of course there is some mixed reactions to the payment changes. We know that, especially for JobSeeker, I feel the Raise the Rate campaign in Australia has been pushing so hard to make these welfare payments a much more livable wage for people. And that's not to say that $800 a fortnight is particularly bad, but it does feel, and to know that it will probably go back to normal in 2021 makes a lot of people feel a bit on edge. Another interesting fact about these payment changes is that people who were working fewer than 20 hours a week before COVID-19 will receive $250 a fortnight, opposed to people working over who will receive $120 per fortnight. This is all before tax. So it's been an interesting week, mixed reactions. There's good and bad in this story, but there is an overall sense of relief. I personally lost my job completely. I worked in travel as well. As radio, I worked in travel, and that's obviously, my job is not going to be resuming anytime soon. So there is a lot of people who are feeling a lot of relief from this. And it's an interesting move from the Morrison government, I'd say.
It's very tough indeed. But moving on, there is also, I think, would you say controversy over and environment protection and biodiversity conservation bill?
Yes, yeah, it's a tricky one to say. The Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act is the first draft of this act has been proposed to has been released, the draft, and there's so many calls on this needing to change before the final release, which is in October, towards the end of the year. So conservationists have criticised the Morrison government's plan to sort of rush through this legislation, implementing a whole new environmental approval rules. They're warning that it is far too vague and won't actually really protect wildlife or the environment for future generations. We know that this, under this coalition government, that their care for the environment is not lacking.
Yeah, not a very good track record on the environment, is it?
Yeah, yeah. You could, to say the least, I feel. And so they've put out this new act that was highly in response to a lot of the climate protests last year and this whole rhetoric around climate that the general public are having at the moment. And to see that this first draft is already being heavily criticised by scientists and conservationists and environmental activists is a bit of a scary step. There does need to be some big changes. The Environmental Minister, Susan Ley, has promised draft laws to change to this Act, and it will be introduced into Parliament in the coming months, in next month, before a review of the legislation, which will be concluded at the end of the year.
Yeah, it's kind of reminiscent of recent, can it be described as environmental blunders, particularly around events like the Adani mine in Queensland. But moving on to today's final topic is about raising the criminal age. And I'm quite interested in this. So what's the story behind this?
So across Australia, children as young as 10 can be arrested by police, charged with an offence, and then put before a court and locked away in prison. It's a pretty blunt statement, but it's actually the complete truth. And so there is now this campaign launched yesterday. It's called Raise the Age, and it's calling on the federal, state and territory governments to do what is obviously right and change these laws to raise the age so children aged 10 to 13 aren't being sent to prison. Obviously, children belong on playgrounds and classrooms and having fun and learning and growing despite, you know, mistakes or circumstances that have been put on to them. The rate of imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people in the Northern Territory, for example, is 43 times the rate for non-Indigenous children, and 17 times the rate nationally, and this is according to some new statistics out as well this week. It's vile, really, to think that young people, especially Indigenous young people, are being locked away at much higher rates than anyone else at such a young age for things like stealing a Freddo frog or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's unacceptable that the government thinks that they could do that. And we have seen in the past things like Gondale Youth Detention Centre and the vile, awful imagery that came out from there and the experiences of these young people in these, you know, prisons. It has to stop. So this campaign is really pushing to do that. And I actually would like to ask your listeners if they would be happy to go to raisetheage.org.au. Hopefully you can access that website from New Zealand. It has a lot of great resources, stories and information about this topic, but it also just has the petition that you can sign. It takes a quick second, and it is calling on all the governments here in Australia to raise the age of imprisonment, which will be very soon put in front of Parliament to be able to change.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was Neighbourhood Watch with me talking to our correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe Canandis. If you want to sign up for the petition that Zoe mentioned on supporting raising the age of criminal responsibility in Australia, you can look it up on www.raisetheage.org.au. We will be going for another break, but now here's Concert by Stormy. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Mais oui, on se connaît bien. T'as même voulu te faire ma mère, hein. T'as commencé par ses seins. Et puis du poumon à mon père, tu t'en souviens? Tu aimes les petits enfants. Décidément, rien ne t'arrête, toi. Et arrête de faire ton innocent. Sur les paquets de cigarettes, fumais-tu? Tu m'étonnes, mais tu m'aides. Que tu cesses tes avances. Quand c'est que tu pars en vacances. Quand c'est, quand est-ce que tu y penses. Quand c'est, ça nous fera des vacances. Quand c'est
you might want to grab a jacket, it's freezing.
I've got a B card.
Okay, well, at least a jumper, you're going to catch a chill or something.
Well, knowing I'm helping BFM stay at the cutting edge of independent broadcasting keeps me warm as. My heart is huge, my cockles are on fire. You should try it sometime.
Okay, well, at least put some pants on.
The B card. Win sick prizes, get incredible discounts, and help us stay Auckland's best radio station since forever. Sign up for a B card from just $4.20 a month. Yeah. And support independent media. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Hello, vegans.
Hello.
Also, hello everyone else.
Hello.
Wonderful. Whatever your dietary requirements, Wise Boys top quality handmade patties, freshly baked buns and lovingly crafted aioli, mayo and sauces are just bloody tasty. With locations in Grey Lynn and now Commercial Bay, it's never been easier to sink your teeth into one of their indulgent plant-based burgers. Wise Boys, check out their delicious burgers, fries and shakes. 604 Great North Road, Grey Lynn, downtown at Commercial Bay or online at wiseboys.nz.
Well, my name is Chris and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the Lynn that's grey. You gotta be cool and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticate, wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
That was The Wire.
Ko ra te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki. That's our show for today. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero me ki au mo tēnei rā. And thank you to those who texted and called in. And also a big thank you to my producer James Tapp and our news director Jemima Houston. Kia ora to all of those who talked to us today. We've got Lisa McPherson, Zoe Canandes, and of course Justice Minister Andrew Little. I will be back next week with James on the side. You're listening to 95BFM now. Enjoy the sunshine and the rest of your week. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.